The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs. There's a revolution outside, my love, gathers what the poet editors Tracy K. Smith and John Freeman call letters from a crisis. Poems, essays, and reflections of all kinds written between June and November in the unprecedented year of loss, pain, uprising, and reckoning that was 2020. I'm pleased this evening to welcome three poets who contributed to this profound anthology of writing, offering solace and providing the community and connection we have longed for during the past year. Camille Dungy is the author of four collections of poetry, most recently Trophic Cascade, winner of the Colorado Book Award. Gregory Pardlow won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for his poetry collection Digest. He teaches in the MFA program at Rutgers University. A professor of creative writing at Dartmouth College, Joshua Bennett is the 2020-2021 visiting scholar at Friends Seminary in New York City and the author of three books of poetry and literary criticism, including The Sobbing School and Ode. Facilitating the conversation is Tripita Mason, our Philadelphia Poet Laureate and the author of She Was Once Herself and Mocha Melodies. Thank you all so very much for being here. And now the screen is all yours.
Okay, good evening. So we're gonna have all of our writers. First of all, we're so happy to have you all with us this evening. Gregory Pardlow, Camille Dungy, and Joshua Bennett. We are elated here in Philadelphia to have these acclaimed writers share their work from this anthology, There's a Revolution Outside, My Love. So we're gonna do a short reading by each of the writers, followed by a discussion and then Q&A. And we're gonna start with Gregory Pardlow, followed by Camille Dungy, and then Joshua Bennett.
Thanks, Tripita. So it's an incredible pleasure to read with my dear friends, Camille and Joshua, and it's also a great honor to be home, however, virtually. You know, my family's from Philadelphia, so I grew up in South Jersey, but I still claim it nonetheless. So I'm reading an epistolary essay that I wrote for, I contributed to the anthology. It's called Dear Juneteenth. Dear Juneteenth, you're a celebrity all of a sudden? Don't get me wrong, I'm happy for you and for the many Americans who now see how important you are. I don't remember the first time I learned about you, but I do know Black folks have been celebrating you for generations. What took the rest of the country so long to catch on? Coincidentally, one of my daughters had a question along these lines, which is the reason for my letter. Why did it take more than 2 years for folks in Texas to get wind that slavery had ended? I've known the answer intuitively, of course. Race is at the heart of just about everything in this country, but I didn't know the details. You probably get this question all the time. Before the pandemic, I was occasionally invited to speak to school children for Black History Month. I always had a presentation prepared. Without turning MLK or Rosa Parks into cartoon heroes or abstracting white supremacy into a scheme for world domination hatched by villains in white hoods, I wanted to have nuanced discussions with kids. Instead, I ended up fielding questions like, do you think things are getting better? And why is your hair so curly? I can only imagine the kinds of challenges you must face in getting your message out now that you're being introduced to so many new people. You have to admit that you are a complicated historical marker. Your name, Juneteenth, absorbs and memorializes the very kind of historical obfuscation that has been used to suggest African Americans have no historical relevance in the life of this country. I'm talking about our pathological ignorance of the central role African Americans have played in the building of the wealth, prosperity, and security that we all enjoy today. But I'm also talking about the practiced obscurantism around basic information that helps us authenticate the stories we tell about ourselves, about who we are individually and collectively. Frederick Douglass believed he was between 27 and 28 years of age when he wrote his life narrative, and lamented that slaves know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs. This was by design, that is, not merely because there was no column for dates of birth in the livestock ledger. Douglass writes, "I was not allowed to make any inquiries of my master concerning my birthday. He deemed all such inquiries on the part of a slave improper and impertinent, and evidence of a restless spirit." What does it mean to be denied, as a matter of principle, anniversaries of any kind? You, Juneteenth, are a brick in the historical foundation upon which our country might reimagine its collective future. This year, we also met COVID-19, which means, like everyone else's, my kid was homebound for most of the school year. She and I were at leisure to think about you as a historical marker and as a call to reflection. The morning of your arrival found her throwing some plush toy at the door in my direction. I was trying to tell her about the history of Texas, to tell her that the Republic of Texas seceded from Mexico because Mexico had abolished slavery. "Why do I care about Texas?" is all I could pick out from the words muffled by the duvet she'd pulled over her head. If you would come on a normal day, I like to think, she'd care about Texas. By that hour in the morning, she would already have made the 45-minute subway ride from Brooklyn to the west side of Manhattan and have been sitting in her ninth grade classroom bursting with questions about Texas. Instead, she's developed the habit of sleeping late and attending, if you count the soundless square displaying her initials as attendance, the optional late morning Zoom sessions some of her teachers offered for an hour each day before she drifted off into a miasma of headphones and group chats. Things were not normal. In the quarantine weeks before you arrived, most mornings, including weekends, a school bell would ring in my mind and I'd leap from bed in a panic. A mashup of climate and virus anxiety made a further mashup with my fear of failing my kids. And together they revised that old nightmare where I walk into a classroom to discover I'm the only one who doesn't know we're having a major exam. In this version of the nightmare, my performance on the exam will determine the physical, financial, and emotional health of my descendants for the next seven generations. It's enough to drive me to turn every space in our home into a makeshift classroom. Needless to say, my kids avoid me and they're not at all subtle about it. Until this year, my oldest daughter had spent her entire educational life at a tiny independent school where she knew every student, teacher, administrator, staff member, and in some cases, their extended families. This was her first year outside of the glass bubble, as she called it. This year, she switched to a public school for multiple reasons. Most of them, I suspect, having to do with race. Only recently, she told her mother and me that once in sixth grade, some boys in her class asked her permission to use the N-word. Apparently, they held Black culture in such high esteem that their thirst for Blackness would not be slaked until they could roll that obscenity on their tongues. They called it privileges, a kind of disposable Blackness that only a Black person could bestow. Only my daughter, as the lone person of color in the class, could do these honors. The irony that these most privileged children would amplify that privilege by leveraging cultural sensitivity against the one person it was intended to protect may have been lost on the children at the time, but it was a formative moment in their developing relationships to race and, it must be specified, gender. The boys learned a toxic etiquette, the transactional logic that will always favor men and people who trade on their privilege. What did my daughter learn? Hers is the perspective that I care about. One day, very soon, after all, she herself will be emancipated. How am I preparing her for that day? And will I be ready to let her go? I want to empower my kid by putting the aggressions she will continue to encounter into structural and historical perspective. I'd like to demystify those aggressions and make sure she knows they grow out of a cultural sickness that has nothing to do with her personally. Had she stayed at her private school, she would not have access to resources for understanding her experiences, nor would she learn ways to respond that would be useful to her. She chose to leave her old school, figuring out for herself what was best. And I admit, I was a little threatened by the independence that that move signaled. Call it patriarchy, systemic racism, call it white supremacy. There's a kind of cultural inertia that will only yield to a substantially opposing force, like the one that has risen in response to the murder of George Floyd. If there had been no pandemic and classroom instruction hadn't been disrupted, would you, Juneteenth, have figured prominently in school curricula? Probably not. The idea that Texas was so remote, the news of emancipation couldn't reach them for 2.5 years is deceptive at best. Yet any historical narrative that challenges the images of America as a nation that has always been devoted to fairness and equality gets spun as slander in the larger culture. Sadly, I believe only the murder of George Floyd could clear a space at all for you, daughter, in the public mind. Thank you. So it's my, again, great pleasure to introduce my friend Camille. Hey, Camille.
Hey there, Greg. I'm happy to be here talking about this book, which I'm gonna read from the book because it's so pretty. It's just a pretty book. Like, I love that fist. There's Gregory's name, and I got it in the mail and went looking for my name, and then I keep losing my name in the sea of other really beautiful names, which is the sign of a really good anthology when there's just so many wonderful works here. So I'm happy to share my piece from this right now. It's a poem. I feel like I should say that, since we are a group here of poets who are also essay writers, and I am putting on my poet hat. Gregory put on his essay writer hat for this collection, and Joshua did a little bit of both in a very Joshua Bennett sort of way. So, okay, are we ready? This'll hurt me more. Don't make me send you outside to find a switch, my grandmother used to say. It was years before I had the nerve to ask her why switch was the word her anger reached for when she needed me to act a different way. Still, when I see some branches, wispy ones like willows, like lilacs, like the tan yellow forsythia before the brighter yellow buds, I think these would make perfect switches for a whipping. America, there is not a place I can wander inside you and not feel a little afraid. Did I ever tell you about that time I was 7, buckled into the back seat of the Volvo, before buckles were a thing America required? My parents tried, despite everything, to keep us safe. It's funny. I remember the brown hills sloping toward the valley, a soft brown welcome I looked for other places, but found only there and in my grandmother's skin. Yes. I have just compared my grandmother's body to my childhood hills, America. I loved them both, and they taught me each things I needed to learn. You have witnessed, America, how pleasant hillsides can quickly catch fire. My grandmother could be like that, but she protected me too. There were strawberry fields, wind-guarded in that valley, tarped against the cold. America, you were good at taking care of what you value. Those silver-gray tarps made the fields look like a pond I could skate on. As the policeman questioned my dad, I concentrated on the view outside the back window. America, have you ever noticed how well you stretch the imagination? This was Southern California. I'd lived there all my life and never even seen a frozen pond. But there I was in 70 degree weather, imagining my skates carving figure eights on a strawberry field. Of course, my father fit the description. The imagination can accommodate whoever might happen along. America, if you've seen a hillside quickly catch fire, you have also seen a river freeze over, the surface looking placid, though you know the water deep down, dark as my father, is pushing and pushing, still trying to get ahead. We were driving home, my father said. My wife and my daughters, we were just on our way home. I know you want to know what happened next, America. Did my dad make it safely home or not? Outside this window, lilac blooms show up like a rash decision the bush makes each spring. I haven't lived in Southern California for decades. A pond here killed a child we all knew. For years after that accident, as spring bloomed and ice thinned, my daughter remembered the child from her preschool. And now, it's not so much that she's forgotten, it's more that it seems she's never known that child as anything other than drowned. My grandmother didn't have an answer. A switch is what her mother called it, and her grandmother before her. She'd been gone from that part of America for over half a century, but still that southern soil sprang up along the contours of her tongue. America, I'll tell you this much. I cannot understand this mind, where it reaches. Even when she was threatening to beat me, I liked to imagine the swishing sound a branch would make as it whipped toward my body through the resisting air. She'd say, "This is hurting me more than it's hurting you." I didn't understand her then, but now I think I do. America, go find me a switch. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Joshua Bennett.
My goodness, Camille, that's stunning. Thank you, everyone that's gathered here today. Thank you to my co-readers, Camille and Gregory, who have taught me so much, both in real time and space, you know, and from a distance. So this is an essay poem, as Camille has already mentioned, entitled "Where Is Black Life Lived?" And it's dedicated to my grandmother, Charlotte Elizabeth Ballard, who passed last year. The plot of ill-gotten land where my grandparents first locked eyes was 116 miles away from the town of Lillington, North Carolina, a place so named for the man that claimed legal ownership over my grandmother's grandmother, as well as the rest of her kin. In spite of the brutal absurdity of this fact, And indeed, in spite of a social and juridical order founded and built from the ground up by such facts, such brutality, my grandmother and grandfather, Charlotte and Levi, persisted. In 1944, they moved from North Carolina to New York. There, my grandmother opened and operated three beauty salons within the boundaries of that irreducibly hip, invincibly Black cultural mecca, Harlem. Over 40 years and seven children, and more than three times that number of grand and great-grandchildren later, I emerged into the world of one of her beauty shops, shimmering from the summertime heat. I was 7 years old. I did not yet know how to spell the word cosmetologist, but I loved that it reminded me of both comic books and comets. My grandmother spent her life making strangers and friends alike feel beautiful. The older women in the salon would pay me a dollar whenever I spelled a word three syllables or longer. Malfeasance, indubitable, recalcitrant, loquacious. When I went on an especially good run, I could walk into the neighborhood bodega with $8 of cold hard cash, stuffed as if contraband into my freshly ironed khaki shorts. Do you know how many peanut chews and Swedish fish you can buy with $8? A lot. To borrow a phrase from June Jordan, I was a millionaire in love. This was where I fell in love with language. I learned to maneuver it, to appreciate its strength. I came to adore the salon for the robust social life it held within its four blue walls. Yes, I was small and still wore high socks. I had a high voice and a high top fade, a laugh too big for my body. Yes, I was a Black American child in a country that despised us and reminded us of that ire quite often, most frequently in the bodies of security guards at our school, or bus drivers who called the police on us when we acted up, or the prison wardens presiding over the cells holding our cousins, parents, big brothers. There was no death in the salon, though. There was only the latest gossip in Motown-era Marvin Gaye on the radio, an entire atmosphere of sounds and smells too perfect to have been engineered on planet Earth. You could have filled 100 beauty shops with what I didn't know back then, but I was acutely aware of a certain truth I have not forgotten since those days. What we built in that space was indeed a refuge, but it was also something infinitely greater than that. It was a world on and in our own terms, a haven and a home. This past March, at the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic, my grandmother, Charlotte Elizabeth Ballard, left this earthly realm. She died with her daughter, my mother, right beside her bed, in the same apartment in the South Bronx Projects, where she hosted Christmas every year, reciting folk tales and Harlem Renaissance era poems from memory. At that point, we did not yet know what the shape of the historical moment would be. We were unprepared. I went to Grandma's funeral via Zoom. When that link failed, several of the distant attending moved to Cousin Jennifer's Facebook Live. The director of the funeral home was a man named Isaiah, whose voice and image now adorn a recent profile from the New York Times entitled, "Coronavirus Ripped a Hole in NYC's Black Community." I remember arguing with him over protocols for social distancing only days before the ceremony. I regret it now. The impossible distance between my Massachusetts apartment and a New York City building packed to the walls with the pandemic dead, an expanse mediated by this invisible tether between us connecting our voices, made a simpler version of the encounter impossible. For much of the service, I could not see my grandmother's face. The angle of my sister's tablet, my cousin's iPhone would not allow it. They did their best. It was all we had available. The commitment to care for our people means you make do with what you have at hand. I wrote her obituary on the same laptop I used to write this letter. The last sentence of it was, "She was loved." Outside, or perhaps alongside the litany of losses we have all experienced during the COVID-19 pandemic, what new ways of feeling close to one another have we cultivated? When I think of the past months, I see both a sequence of tragedies and an ongoing refusal to be destroyed by them relayed through a screen. The funeral, the news of the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Tony McDade, Elijah McClain, and so many others, numerous family members diagnosed with the virus, not being able to remember the last time I held a friend or even spoke to one as we sat in the same room. Adjacent to these more difficult moments somehow is the process of my becoming a parent, seeing my child grow as the landscape transforms around us. In honor of that surreal and yet wonderful occasion, I thought it might make sense to take some time today and share at least one of the pieces of writing that has taken on new meaning for me, given my particular experience of grief and celebration in this period. I was witnessing, on the one hand, the state of emergency caused by the converging pandemics currently engulfing our planet, not only COVID-19, of course, but anti-Blackness, that perennial ecological catastrophe, and on the other, the emergence of my son into the realm of the living. The most human thing I could do here, I realized, was to provide a window into the varying forms of mediation that have shaped my days, as well as the forms of human sociality that strain against and emerge through those forms of distance. The laptop screen, the baby center app on my phone, the revolving glass door at the hospital. Seeing a colleague on the street and raising our elbows in solidarity, our masks failing to cover our smiles entirely. This letter ends in a poem, is what I'm trying to say. It's from a sequence that's at the core of a new book I'm writing about Black disposability, environmental degradation, and fatherhood. It recalls a world before the pandemic and gestures toward the one we are building together even now in the midst of it. One more thing. I've been thinking quite a bit recently about the role of air in African-American letters. The People That Could Fly, Eric Garner, Christina Sharp highlighting the link between anti-Black racism and the weather. It bears remembering. For the legal studies scholar and foundational critical race theorist Derek Bell, one of the first characteristics of the Black utopia he describes in his classic vignette, The Afro-Lantica Awakening, is that it is simply a place where we can breathe, a space of celebration and retreat, somehow flourishing both inside and beyond the constraints of the present order. The sanctuary, the dance hall, my grandmother's salon glistening at a distance. When we turn to the written page, where is Black life lived? Anywhere, everywhere, underwater, outer space, underground, even where there is no air at all. We imagine it as if it were otherwise. We conjure a world that is worthy of us, and then we gather there, unbowed, unburied, unabashed in our joy. Benediction. God bless the lightning bolt in my little brother's hair. God bless our neighborhood barber, the patience it takes to make a man you've just met beautiful. God bless every beautiful thing called monstrous since the dawn of a colonizer's time. God bless the arms of the mother on the crosstown bus, the sterling silver cross at the crux of her collarbone, its shine barely visible beneath her nightshade navy New York Yankees hoodie. God bless the baby boy kept precious in her embrace, his wail turning my entire row into an opera house. God bless the vulnerable ones, how they call us toward love and its infinite, unthinkable cost. God bless the floss, the flash, the brash and bare knuckle brawl of the South Bronx girls who raised my mother to grease knuckles, cut eyes, get fly as any fugitive dream on the lam, on the run from the law, as any and all of us are who dare to wake and walk in this skin. And you best believe God bless this skin, the shimmer and slick of it, the wherewithal to bear the rage of sisters, brothers slain, and still function each morning, still sit at a desk, send an email, take an order, dream a world, some heaven big enough for Black life to flourish, to grow. God bless the no, my story is not for sale. The no, this body belongs to me and the earth alone. The sea, the thing about souls, is they by definition cannot be owned. God bless the beloved flesh our refusal calls home. God bless the unkillable interior, bless the uprising, bless the rebellion, bless the overflow. God bless everything that survives the fire. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, speaking of the fire, God bless the poets, the writers, the essayists. Thank you all. This was beautiful. Joshua, thank you. Gregory, Camille, beautiful. And Camille did the right thing by just pointing out, this is the book. This is the beautiful cover. And Camille, I found your name. It is right next to Gregory's on the side there. And everyone's names on this cover. But this is a wonderful book. There's a revolution outside, my love. And all of these readings are from this collection. So we're going to have a time for a short conversation, and then we're going to take some Q&A. So Joshua, since you read last, this is a quote that I took from your work. I enjoyed hearing the story of your family's migration and the salons, and I was envisioning all of this. And the quote about there was no death in the salon, though. There was only the latest gossip and Motown era Marvin Gaye on the radio, an entire atmosphere of sounds and smells too perfect to have been measured on planet Earth. So I'm going to start with you first, Joshua, and then with the Camille and Gregory. You talked about this, all of you writing about the losses, the pandemic, and all of these things that happened in the past year, have been happening in the past years. But Joshua, specifically, you talked about it as both a series of tragedies and an ongoing refusal to be destroyed by them. So I do want to hear from each of you about how this balance finds its way in your work. You write the stories about, and the people that you write about, acknowledging and naming the violence, the losses, the destruction, but also calling out the spirit of refusing to be destroyed by them. So is that important to you to kind of have this balance in your work, and how do you reflect that? So we'll start with you, Joshua.
Sure, that's a fantastic question. I guess how I balance it is just by doing my best to put up a mirror to what I know to be true, right? Which is that I was raised by Black people who loved being Black. They loved other Black people. They loved other people who weren't Black too, but I think even that had something to do with their experience of Blackness, which was just that even though their position was denigrated from the outside, they knew they were human beings and they had a fundamental commitment to a human project. Mm-hmm. And my poems are just me trying to think about that stuff out loud and make music out of it, you know, make music out of my grandmother's salon and of my big sister teaching me how to fight when I was little, and the corner bodega, and you know, the basketball court that was, you know, too dangerous for me to actually play at, but I spent time sort of walking past there as a boy and learning about what language could do, you know. So the cover to my book, Ode, that's me and my dad, you know. This is real rap raw. This is my actual life. And I think trying to write from that space has mandated that I balance, you know, because they're actual living people, you know. It's my wife in the background, hi Pam. And I think having sort of my family in front of me, having my family and friends in the poems has kept me honest in a certain way, you know. Like I can't just go in there and kind of tamp down the color and vibrance of their beautiful lives.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So I think that sort of responsibility has been really, really helpful. And the last thing I'll say too, just because I mentioned becoming a parent, I think all the different ways that I had to try to be close to my son, even though I wasn't even allowed to go to the ultrasounds, I think taught me something about human persistence, mm-hmm. like pacing around the block mm-hmm. as my wife Pam snuck in a cell phone so I could be on FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And that being the first time I even saw an image of my boy August wow. Galileo, you know, and how incredible that moment even felt. Mm-hmm. And that I just had an epiphany in that instant. Like, oh, if we can forge deep meaning and connection across this kind of distance, then all sorts of things are possible, you know,
yeah.
If we imagine together.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Thank you. So Camille or Gregory, either one, if you want to answer that.
I can jump in. Yeah. So I was thinking about the complexity of that were the name of the holiday, which is a non-name, right? It's not an actual date, but it commemorates as much as it refuses to be sort of pinned down. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of, you know, metaphorical of the very thing that you're talking about, right? This persistence in the face of this kind of overwhelming, seemingly overwhelming oppression. So So when I talked about the visiting the classes, right, and throughout the piece, I'm trying to balance this sense of the tragedy, that the immediate tragedy that we're living through and the historical tragedies that we're living through, with this kind of quotidian, very, you know, normal life. We are nonetheless here getting up, going to school, or, you know, and dealing with the computer and the Wi-Fi and throwing the pillows at each other, and, you know, life goes on, right? So it was very important for me to depict the that ongoingness. So when I talked about the visiting the class, I wanted to highlight the fact that we so often will think about it in the media, think about the Black experience as this just, you know, overwhelming social death, which, yes, absolutely, that is part of it. But we tend to, and MLK and Rosa Parks, right, they get sort of dehumanized in this supernatural way. And so I wanted to say, you know, yes, life is still actually happening. There is real, you know, human experience here. And when we abstract it into, you know, this, and I say melodrama, not to diminish the horror of it, right? But to suggest that it takes our attention away from the fact of our survival, mm-hmm. our thriving, mm-hmm. and as Joshua points out, our joy, mm-hmm. right? And so I wanted to find a way to have those concepts coexist, and the holiday of Juneteenth is just very representative of that to me.
Yeah, and it came across really clearly. Thank you for that, Gregory. Camille, did you want to jump in?
Well, they've both said so much. So I think what I might be able to add to that is something of an extension of what Joshua said. And this is generational, you know, the line that I have in my poem about my parents buying a Volvo with backseat seatbelts before backseat seatbelts were a thing that we did in America. Like, yeah. The ways in which we pass on joy and support and love and protection from generation to generation, that's a really important part of survival and celebration that needs to be spoken about. And yes. Sometimes it looks super mundane, right? Like mm-hmm. getting a boring boxy car, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it looks a lot more difficult and dangerous and impossible.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Camille, you were, there's a line in your poem that stayed with me and continues even now after I've read it. And it's, America, there is not a place I can wander inside you and not feel a little afraid. And it's just so powerful. And some of the collections, the letters offer either a lesson, a prayer, a balm, a path to foster healing. And I wanted to ask you, and then Joshua and Gregory, in your writing process, or what is your intention? How much of it is about dealing with that fear, that fear from a place of power? Because it sounds like by the time you get to the end of your poem, you're asking for this switch, right? To kind of put it back on. And I'm just wondering, like, how much of this, is it important to you to show this, like to put the power back in the hand of the other person, you know, sort of the other way? I just love how you beautifully wove this and got to that point by the end of your poem.
I remember the week I wrote this poem, and the just perpetual exhaustion and rage I was in. It was just this oscillation between exhaustion and rage. And it was one of those weeks when all my white friends were calling to check on me, which was meant out of kindness and grace and support. But I'm also like, y'all, this is not new. It's not new and it's not over. So are you going to keep calling me next month and a couple months after that? And, you know, honestly, the answer is no in a lot of cases now that these big, big ticket stories are out of the headlines, right? And so I was just tired and frustrated. And how far back can I go with these stories, right? So how long can I remember these this kind of perpetual terror and concern and the consistency of fitting the description that means that your life is imperiled? But I also know that nothing is going to change in this country if Black people are the only ones talking about these things, mm-hmm. obviously, because we've been talking about them. Like, it's not new. Gregory brings up Frederick Douglass. Like, it's from the beginning. It's a get-go kind of situation. We've been telling these stories eloquently mm-hmm. and graphically and beautifully and anyly that you want. We've been telling these stories. So unless there's buy-in from America, mm-hmm. right? From this kind of larger culture of America to switch the behavior, yeah. to correct the behavior, to look at the damage and take accept the consequences mm-hmm. and take action, then nothing's going to happen. So yes, the poem was out of a point of direct address mm-hmm. to this larger culture. Here's the situation as I can lay it out. And for me, I'm like my daughter in that story. I can't remember a time when that child was anything other than drowned, right? Like, this is not new to me. And so let me give you some examples of what that looks like for me and ask what it means for you, reader, listener, culture, to initiate a switch and to like make a change that will hurt. Right? That is demanding right. of you in some really specific ways.
Right. Powerful. Thank you. Thank you. Very powerful. And I don't know, Gregory or Joshua, do you have anything to add before I go on to my last question and we open for question? Audience, you can, listeners, you can put questions into the question box and we're happy to answer them. Go ahead, Joshua.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, like my comment before, I think my vantage on this is just born from both intimacy and study, right? Like the people that raised me, they weren't scary, you know? I mean, it's in the Black sense, right? Like they weren't really shook in general. Like they knew racism was real. They knew cops were everywhere. They knew people that we knew well from the block could one day turn on you and try to rob you or do you harm. And yet there was a kind of courage and especially kind of moral courage and persistence that was just demanded of us in part because of our conditions where we live, but also that was the tradition, you know, of the children's books I had. They were about Mary McLeod Bethune, you know, and Ida B. Wells and George Washington Carver and Douglass and Tubman. And so I guess from the time I was quite small, I knew that this sort of fear was well earned, right? But also that it was a totally human emotion, much like anger, right? And much like joy. And that as a Black person in the United States, I should always feel free, like truly free to tap into that entire spectrum, not just in my writing, but in my everyday life, right? Because I was a human being. And I think that was a really important lesson that I just kept with me as I, you know, became a Black studies major and read June Jordan and Audre Lorde and Lucille Clifton and George Jackson and Assata Shakur, right? And I'm not saying that litany for no reason. I mean, all of those people wrote quite extensively about anger, right? I mean, June in particular, one of my favorite passages from her, she talks about how, you know, even when she wouldn't win fights as a girl, nobody wanted to fight June Jordan twice, right? Because she said she fought you while she was out of her mind because she wanted to leave you with the memory, mm-hmm. right? And so for me, I always thought about that as a certain kind of inheritance. Like that's a literary inheritance for me, is that we wrestle with our fear, right? But we're not overcome by it. And we believe in self-defense because we believe we have selves to defend and because we love ourselves and love our communities and love our children and because we love the earth, You know, so we stand up for it and we steward it. So trying to have that kind of planetary scope to it, which I get in large part from Camille's work and her incredible contribution, right, to Black life and letters and American life and letters, that's really helped me be less afraid to understand myself as part of an ancient tradition of people who were militating against a kind of desire to destroy the earth and all of the beauty it holds, you know.
Yeah, I'll just add really quick that, Joshua, maybe Camille, you can correct me. I think it was bell hooks, says freedom is the absence of fear. And I think what I want to do with my work is demonstrate an absence of fear, right? And that is to countenance the injustices, the systemic oppression, the larger than life, you know, sublime, awful oppression, and as I say, you know, stand in the presence of it and think through it without cowering, without having been cowed by it, right? And to demonstrate that in the work, I think my similar sort of family memories. But my father's sort of comportment was in the face of that police officer, Camille's police officer, was, yes, absolutely. What do you need? Yeah, sure, pal, right? You know, he's just, I am absolutely, you will not find me discomforted, put out. It may, whatever extent it was a performance, it was nonetheless, you know, an assertion of resistance. And yeah, so I think that's how I come down on that issue.
Okay. So, and Gregory, since you're talking in your Juneteenth piece, you're talking about Juneteenth being treated almost like this celebrity. It's popular now. We're all getting, it's almost June, so we're all getting these calls to, you know, do different things or write a Juneteenth poem. And I'm just wondering, as it relates to the work and all these lovely pieces that people wrote about what's happening out here, in addition to the pandemic, the state violence, the oppression against Black bodies, all this attention now, you're seeing things about DEI, everyone's hiring for this, everyone's doing this. Do you think, like Juneteenth, that the resurgence of this movement, it's fleeting as well? It has this spotlight, and then Camille, you mentioned it's been since Douglas time and before. It ebbs and flows, but we've been talking about it and feeling it forever. So in your work, is there an urgency to archive and record this time, this moment?
An urgency, no. A responsibility, absolutely.
Okay.
So, you know, I think about the notion of progress. So the child in the classroom says, do you think things are getting better? Mm. Right. And I think that's a very white American hope, right? Please tell me we're better off now than we were, yeah, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And, you know, that our investment in a kind of narrative progress, I think is part of the self-deception, mm-hmm, right? No, I don't think we're different. Our circumstances are very different. And so what's going to happen with Juneteenth, as I allude to in part of the piece that I didn't read, is that if, as Camille points out, if you continue calling me, you know, if you keep this up, then that impulse will be Disneyfied and commercialized in some way, commodified in some way, and it'll be baked into the culture so that we can then, you know, go back to the injustices and imbalances that that this country, quite frankly, is dependent upon.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you. Question, Mia or Joshua?
I mean, I think at this point in my life, I feel like any language can get co-opted. Like any radical language, I see people identifying as like prison abolitionists that are super scared to walk through Harlem. I mean, stuff that just feels so completely incongruous to me that I don't even know how folks hold it together. So what I would say is, I think we're so imaginative I think our people are so brilliant and so creative that we'll just come up with something new, right? Like, even if this moment is fleeting in that way in terms of institutional supports, mm-hmm. I think we'll build new institutions and we'll figure out new ways to get somewhere else, right? Like the first time I heard Nate Mackey ever talk in public about fugitivity, the way he defined it was so crisp and clear to me. And he said, it's about Black folks moving from one situation onto a better situation. Right. Or at least the desire for it is fugitivity, the flight from where you are to somewhere you imagine just holds other newer possibilities. And I think we'll always do that. You know,
thank you.
It'd be great to have some kind of material support as we do it. But I think no matter what, you know, in the face of degradation and destruction, we'll create and we'll build something beautiful.
Wonderful.
Thank you. You know, one of the things for me about being an art maker is that I said I was exhausted and full of rage, and I woke up that morning and I wrote that poem and I felt better.
That's right.
Right? Like, it's that there is something about making art, having a space to hold your grief and your anger and your celebrations and your joys and your questions and your hopes, having a place that you can craft and you can make and you can own, right? Yes, that is yours, that you were the maker of.
Yes.
I'm not giving that away. Right. And so for that reason, I think that it is necessary for us to continue to make this work. Right. Because it is necessary for us to sing, to speak, to laugh, to cry, to do all those things that we do in writing. And it's necessary for us to share that work with those readers who are there with us right now and will be with us sometime later and need to be in community, right? Yes. It's like the space of the fellowship of the church, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, like that beauty of being community with like-minded people, mm-hmm. That's necessary. Yes. And writing allows that to happen. And so for that reason alone, I think this is crucial, right? Whether or not the nation moves forward or gets better or what, like, I have made my art and I have made my community of like-minded people who are my comrades and my readers. And okay,
that
sometimes is enough.
Camille, I just love that. And that release and that it's enough. Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. And we have a question from someone, Wallace Torrey. And the question is, thank you for your soaring contributions and moving readings this evening. To Joshua's point about inheritance, do you think literature/poetry provides a place where we can authentically inherit each other's cultures across ethnicity, race, et cetera, and make them a part of who we are? It's an interesting question. Do you think literature, poetry provides a place where we can authentically inherit each other's cultures?
That's a wonderful question. I don't know if inherit is the word that I would use in that sense, because I think to me, inheritance means something about genetic or adoptive lineage, which is direct in a sense. But appreciate, experience, come to really know these things. Yes, I think all evidence to how art changes culture, how art moves culture forward step by step, and exchange by exchange. That does seem to suggest absolutely that poetry, that literature in general are opportunities to have empathetic and really genuine connections with people outside of our own bodies, right? And I live in full faith of that. If that were not the case, I like to say, like, if that were not the case, we wouldn't still be reading Sappho, right? Mm-hmm. Because that is, she lived in a completely different time, completely different culture, but there's enough human interchange that I'm willing to learn what the differences were, right? Mm-hmm. For me to be able to do that, for me able to read Basho, for the Negritude poets to be able to have brought their connections with the African diaspora to French and to English minds, right? All of these things mean that we can have these sort of from beyond us connections. But again, I'm not entirely sure that I would call that inheritance in the same way that I would call something that I got from a biological or, like I say, adoptive. But to me, like an adoptive family means like you're in that family, right? Whether you share that DNA or not. Yeah. And I don't know how much readers want to go that far, right? To fully enter in that sense. If you're up for that, that's fantastic, right?
Yeah, it's a heavy lift. Joshua?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really interested. Yeah, I agree with Camille. And I'm really interested in what Edouard Glissant calls relation, right? Which at one point in Poetics of Relation, he describes as opacities colliding. And I'm really interested in that, right? The idea that it's not just about empathy as a kind of fellow feeling, but rather that our apartness is okay. Like the distance between us is productive and beautiful and useful. Mm-hmm. And what we call care or love or poetry is just us trying to like cast a tether across that distance, right? Mm-hmm. And whether you get across it is not really the whole point, right? It's really like the gesture and the act and that moment that you share with this other irreducibly complex being. So recently, for example, for my son, I've been trying to learn a lot more about Puerto Rican poets and learning about Miguel Alegrín in particular, who I'm writing about right now. And at first that was just about, you know, spoken word, right? And thinking more deeply about spoken word history. But reading about Alegrín and learning that he had a PhD in comp lit, right? And they started the New Eurekan Cafe in his living room and just invited over a bunch of his friends that came from this incredible, you know, cross-section of cultures and groups. Intozaki Shange was a founding, you know, a poet of the New Eurekan Cafe. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, like a deep kinship there, like just seeing his dreams and the fact that he started this place really for his friends, for all these beautiful, talented poets, just so they could, you know, showcase their stuff and to make a room for his people. And I didn't think of that as an inheritance I got from Miguel, right? It was more just like a string maybe I could pull from a distance, right? And that was more than enough. You know, that was infinitely more than enough, you know, may he rest, you know. But even while Miguel was alive, while I was reading about his work from a distance, unable to come to New York and interview him as I'd originally intended when I started out with this book, I was blown away by even seeing the way the archival documents made me feel close to him. So mm-hmm. I think poems can do that, you know, and infinitely more. There's so many poets living and dead who I feel like helped build my brain or something. Mm-hmm. You know, the poems were so good that I cannot imagine my own thinking without the lines of verse from these people who span the centuries. So yeah, more so than any kind of gift passed down in a traditional like inheritance fashion, I'm interested in those bonds, you know, across space and time, those invisible tethers between us.
Wonderful. What a way to end, what a way to close. This hour just flew by. And I'm so grateful to Camille Dungy, Gregory Pardlow, and Joshua Bennett, and also to the Free Library of Philadelphia. We're also grateful to Tracy K. Smith and John Freeman for this lovely book where all of the works are featured. We want to mention that the books are available at a Joseph Fox Bookshop, and there's a link right in the chat with that information. All of the writers on here are very heavy social, they're on social media, they're all over. All you have to do is Google their name and you'll see all of the accolades and the wonderful, wonderful work they're doing out in the world. So please do that. Support the writers, support poets, get the book. Thank you to our listeners, for all of you for attending this evening. This was really special. Poets, writers, thank you. Scholars, we appreciate you being with us. And everybody have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, everybody.
This is awesome.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it's good to see you guys.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.